The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, reporter Annie Ngo recounts being attacked by Antifa in Portland.
I just kept thinking that the police were going to come in and save me at any point, and that never happened.
Larry Elder looks back at the housing crisis.
This was a reparations program. And look how it affected things.
David Drucker discusses the Epstein fallout.
The hangman could come for others as well.
And Alan Dershowitz finds his name on the dubious list.
I will be completely cleared and vindicated for something I didn't do.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more, listen more at HughHewitt.com. Let me invite you to join us now by video. For decades, the left has been known more as pacifist than violent, but times have changed, and few groups represent that change in a more troubling fashion than the violent far-left group known as Antifa. They hit the streets in all black, faces covered and armed with whatever weapons they can slip past law enforcement, and they often outnumber their opposition by a considerable margin. 2 weeks ago, in the troubled city of Portland, Oregon, a small gathering of right-wing protesters was met by a massive Antifa counter-protest. And as usual, it turned violent. Reporter Andy Ngo was one victim of the cowardly, unprovoked Antifa attacks. Those attacks left him hospitalized. How the officers of Portland handled his beating is just as troubling. He spoke with my friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
Just briefly recount to us what happened in Portland and when this happened.
It happened last Saturday, 29th of June. What happened was that Antifa and their allies had organized a demonstration to protest some right-wing groups that were holding some separate events in downtown. And they had it be a milkshake-themed event, which to people who aren't following politics might think that sounds kind of cute and fun, but it's actually referencing the act of milkshaking people, which is where people dump drinks on public figures that they perceive to be right-wing or conservative. So I came there as a journalist. I've documented many of their public protests. They've hated me for it because I've shown the public how prone they are to attack the public indiscriminately. While they were chanting, "No hate, no fear," and this was steps from the Justice Center in the heart of downtown, so right by the Central Police Precinct, the Sheriff's Office, what I remember is hearing them chant this. I'm walking towards the front of the demonstration. I have a GoPro in my hand, was about to record the front of the demonstration. Before I could get there, something or someone bashes me in the back of my head really hard, and I lose my balance. And I'm an extremely passive person. I've never been in a fight. Don't know what a punch is supposed to feel like. So before I even sort of process what happened, then all the hits kept coming from all the directions. And in the video that's gone viral, that's the second half of the attack. There was an additional other half that I don't know if that was recorded or not. I haven't seen it. But they were going for my head and my face over and over, and I just saw being surrounded by these bodies dressed head to toe in black with their masks. They had on their gloves, and they were punching me with these gloves that have these hard plastic material on the knuckles. So they were using their hands as deadly weapons to my face. I just kept thinking that the police are going to come in and save me at any point, and that never happened. when I thought that this mob was done beating me, I was wrong as well. They then started hailing down the storm of milkshakes and eggs and other liquids that I don't know right in my face. So I couldn't even see because I was blinded. It got all in my eyes. So I didn't know even which way to walk to run to leave. And then this is where you've seen the video. Some of them punched me some more, kicked me some more. So
So you were beaten, and they had these plastic knuckles in their gloves beating your face. You just assumed, as I would, well, the police are going to just break this up. What did the police do?
Absolutely nothing. You know, sorry for that long description of the beating earlier, but that's not even all of, there's like more. So they beat me so hard, I lost control of my motor controls, my hands. So that was when they robbed me of my GoPro. And I was trying to hold on to that so hard because I was thinking, this is my evidence for these people attacking me. I didn't know how many people were involved. There were so many, but they, one of the, I just remember somebody dressed in black grabbed it and ran off. I lost that, and then came that hailstorm of all the stuff and the shakes and eggs in my face. So when I was stumbling away, bloody days, I was thinking, okay, police are going to now come into me now that they're done beating me. Police are going to help, and that didn't happen. I walked, had to walk across the park to the other side of the street. That was when I lost balance. I sat down, ironically, right in front of the county courthouse, and then the SWAT medics came to me and let me know that the ambulance was waiting for me at the police precinct, but they could not escort me there. I had to walk back there on my own.
Why could they not escort you there?
Because at this point, this mob of people were moving towards Pioneer Hill Courthouse Square. So there was like other stuff that was happening down in other parts of the city. I don't know if they were stretched thin or what, but they left me alone. That was shocking to me because I had to walk back towards where all these people were. I was angry that the ambulance couldn't just come to me, and I think the ambulance couldn't because the streets got shut down by this unlawful demonstration because there was people all over the streets.
This is a tremendous indictment of the Portland police. How could a person be beaten in the streets of a major city in America, recorded by video, and the police do nothing? There has to be a reason. Do you have a reason?
It comes from above. I place the blame at the feet of our mayor, Ted Wheeler, who also doubles as a police commissioner. Since he's been elected, he's witnessed and experienced and seen the brutality of Antifa on our streets and has not given law enforcement the ability to bring order to the city.
Reparations, once seen as complete nonsense, is quickly becoming a hot topic among Democrats seeking to represent their party in the 2020 presidential campaign. But according to Larry Elder, this has already happened, and it was a disaster.
There was the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission set up by government, and when it came out, there were two competing views as to what happened regarding the housing meltdown. The majority view, signed on to by the Democrats on the commission, all said that this was basically failure of government to oversee what was going on with Wall Street. It had a bunch of players there that were doing this and doing that, and it was the lack of oversight that caused the meltdown. And the solution, of course, is therefore more oversight. The second theory is that the former had nothing to do with it. This is all about government policy that effectively changed lending standards, and a whole bunch of people who in the past would not have had a home because they did not have between 10 and 20% down payment, did not have a good working record, did not have a good enough FICO score, did not have a good enough debt-to-income ratio. In years past, if your debts exceeded maybe 38% or so of your income, you weren't going to get the house. But because of the pressure put on banks, that standard changed. That's the second theory as to what happened. Which one is right? Well, there's a guy named John Carney. John Carney is a senior editor of CNBC. He has an article in Business Insider with the following headline. Here's how the Community Reinvestment Act led to the housing bubble's lax lending. And he starts out by admitting that at one time he subscribed to theory number one, that there wasn't enough oversight. Quote, earlier this week, he writes, I noted I had changed my mind on the Community Reinvestment Act. Contrary to my initial conclusion, the evidence is overwhelming that the CRA played a significant role in creating lax lending standards that fueled the housing bubble. Once I realized this, he writes, I had to abandon my suspicion that the anti-CRA case was a figment of the rhetoric of Republicans attempting to distract attention from their own role in the mortgage mess. End of quote. And that's exactly what happened. I'm watching the debate over what caused this, and I'm hearing people say, well, that's just Republican rhetoric. Peter Wollaston was a member of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. He wrote an article. It's called The True Origins of This Financial Crisis. And he talks about the two competing theories. One has to do with lack of oversight, which is what the left believes. And the other one has to do with government policy, which is, in my opinion, the accurate analysis. And he talks about how the Community Reinvestment Act was passed in 1977. It was vague, and it mandated that regulators consider whether an insured bank was serving the needs of the whole community. And for 16 years, nobody did much of anything. But in comes Bill Clinton, because there was a 1992 Federal Reserve Bank study of Boston that found out, while there was no overt discrimination in banks' allocation of mortgage funds, lending officers gave whites preferential treatment, close quote. Again, no overt discrimination. It's just that black borrowers were being turned down at a rate higher than white would-be borrowers. What it doesn't state is that Asian would-be buyers were approved at a higher rate than white would-be borrowers. So unless you're prepared to say that banks are discriminating against blacks, but discriminating in favor of Asians and against white applicants, then it has to do with one's credit worthiness, doesn't it? So in comes Bill Clinton, and he puts teeth in the CRA. And the teeth are, if you don't lend to a certain percentage of low-income borrowers and you don't have a good CRA score, we're going to hold up your ability to merge, hold up your ability to install ATMs, hold up your ability to install new branches. And so this put pressure on the entire lending standards. And as a result, a whole bunch of people had homes that they otherwise would not have gotten, a disproportionately high percentage of whom happened to be black and brown borrowers. So when the housing crisis hit, people lost their jobs. Between the year 2010 and 2013, a substantial percentage of black net worth declined. I read between 20 and 25% between 2010 and 2013, all because a bunch of people had homes that they wouldn't have had but for the relaxation of these standards, which were relaxed in order to improve the percentage of black and brown borrowers. Ergo, this was a reparations program. And look how it affected things.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Coming up, the disgusting case of Jeffrey Epstein.
The hangman could come for others as well.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Financier Jeffrey Epstein was convicted many years ago of sex crimes against children. He served just 13 months behind bars. Federal agents say they have now uncovered more and convincing evidence against him for sex trafficking and prostituting underage girls. At the same time, his ties to Democrats and Republicans are long and deep. Former President Bill Clinton, for instance, has spent considerable time aboard Epstein's jet. Donald Trump gave a quote about Jeffrey Epstein years ago. He's well known. And as prosecutors gather more information, it's clear the takedown of this registered sex offender will lead to the exposure of additional vile individuals. And perhaps some of them may turn out to be public figures. The prior plea deal of a decade ago has many turning their anger towards Labor Secretary Alex Acosta, who helped secure that deal over a decade ago. Before Acosta's press conference last Wednesday, I spoke with David Drucker, senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. I began the interview by playing a portion of my conversation with Labor Secretary Acosta from the month before. You can't go anywhere these days without people asking you about the Epstein plea deal. Is that ever going to be in the rearview mirror for you?
Well, you know, the Department of Justice Office of Professional OPR is taking a look at that, and they will, in when they're concluded, issue a report.
And so any idea when that will happen? Because it seems to me a lot of the great work the department is doing is obscured by the, there's frankly Trump derangement syndrome as a part of this as well. But this story is controversial and it needs to go to rest soon. Do you have any idea when that's going to come out?
Well, the department has its own timeline. We're proceeding on our work and we're focusing on the economy and jobs. And that's what we're doing right now.
So, David Drucker, that was 2 months ago. Will that work now?
No.
Agreed.
It just, you know, this story now is a new story that is fresh. It's going to, it, not only does it have a life of its own, but there is now, you know, new information. And we're going to get even more information. And I don't know in terms of his involvement, what's fair and what's not, what's true and what's not. It's just one of those things in politics and in life, frankly, where sometimes, even if it's not fair, it doesn't matter because of, you know, how, number one, egregious, you know, the allegations against Mr. Epstein are, but also, you know, when people are reexamining something wrong and they're trying to make it right, even if at the time somebody did something that everybody said was okay, later on, when people decide it's not, then, you know, you have to pay for that sin. And that's just the matter. That's just politics in America. But also, you know, we've seen this happen before.
Now, I have no hesitation saying Epstein is a scumbucket. He's a convicted child molester. He pled guilty. I didn't like the deal, but the way it was explained to me off air is that this was because the state authorities were so freaking incompetent, it was the best the federal authorities could do. That may or may not be true. All I know is he's a scumbucket who should spend the rest of his life in jail. I just am curious, when does the hangman come for Alex Acosta?
Well, you know, I think it could come quick, but I think part of that depends on what we start learning because of these, you know, new charges and this new investigation. But the hangman could come for others as well, because now that the federal government is handling this in a modern context, not in the context of, you know, 20 years ago, we could learn a whole lot more. And there's as horrible as what he, you know, did is, there's even less tolerance for it today from a legal standpoint and a political standpoint.
And so if he starts to sing in order to get himself a better cell room, because he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail, he's never getting out. All right. He's a two striker. He's never going to get out. They're going to get one of the women and they're going to get a third strike. He's just never going to get out. So he's got every incentive to try and go to the least dangerous place, because child molesters don't do well in prison for obvious reasons. People hate them. He's going to start singing and telling people everything. When do you have any idea when that's going to start to unravel? Because, by the way, it's going to take out Republicans and Democrats, and good Godspeed that they all get taken out.
Yeah, look, I mean, I don't know how quickly this is all going to happen, but, you know, you have to imagine that he's going to talk. He, you know, according to some reports, has a whole bunch of evidence that he kept around from years ago. And so I just think this is the kind of story, too, where you're going to see most people try and keep their head down and not say much because they don't know how this thing is going to reverberate. Although, very interestingly, former President Clinton put out a statement very, very quickly yesterday.
But I do know this. I do know that he was denied bail, so they've got a risk of flight. They're not going to go Mark Rich on this. This will play out, and it's going to get everybody. I think that they will. They'll get everybody. Do you agree with me, David Drucker?
I mean, look, I would think. But, you know, we'll have to see. Obviously, it would depend on what he says, what kind of evidence there is to back that up. But somebody like this who's used to using favors to get out of things, I'm sure he's going to try that again.
Famed criminal lawyer Alan Dershowitz was one of those who represented Epstein over 10 years ago. And he's been accused by rape by a woman who claims to be tied to the Epstein circle. Dershowitz spoke with Salem host Joe Piscopo on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
They unsealed this indictment against Jeffrey Epstein yesterday, alleging some pretty serious crimes, Professor. You've done some legal work for him before. Give us your reaction to this whole situation, considering regarding Epstein.
Well, we really don't know enough. The indictment itself is fairly bare bone. From my point of view, the important thing is that it doesn't mention me. As you know, David Boies has been on a campaign to try to accuse me of things. But all of his three clients, every one of his three clients, has been proven to be a perjurer. You know, the first person who accused me also said she had dinner with Bill Clinton on Jeffrey Epstein's island with two underage girls. And yesterday issued a statement saying he was never on Epstein's island, and the Secret Service confirmed that. So here you have a woman who's been just lying about Bill Clinton. She also claimed she saw Al Gore and Tip O'Gore on the island. They don't even know Jeffrey Epstein. Another woman, David Boies, issued an affidavit on behalf of. She sent letters, emails to the New York Post saying she had sex tapes of Hillary Clinton, of Donald Trump, of Bill Clinton, and of Richard Branson. The New York Post, of course, said she's not credible, and they refused to print her allegations on page six. But David Boies submitted an affidavit on her behalf. And so, you know, the question is twofold. Number one, are these women in general credible? And I have no reason to believe they're not. But are the women who have been recruited by David Boies to earn him money? And he was trying, according to this woman's best friend, to get a $1 billion legal settlement from Leslie Wexner. I mean, the whole goal was to publicly accuse me falsely and then to go to Leslie Wexner, which David Boies did personally, went and saw his lawyer, and say, if you don't want to have happen to you what happened to Dershowitz, there are ways of resolving this. So there's a lot more that has to be looked into. I'm glad the FBI is finally looking into this. I wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal urging the FBI to investigate this case. I took the Boies' accusation to the U.S. Attorney's Office, to the FBI, and to the district attorney and asked them to investigate. And finally, the FBI is involved in the case. So I'm confident that at least I will be completely cleared and vindicated for something I didn't do. I never met these people. I didn't know them. Just a totally made-up story.
For more of that conversation, go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, what we must do.
Compete with China, avoid a violent shooting war with China, and fix up our country at home.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Who are our enemies? The media has been focused mostly on Russia, partly due to their desire to tie the election of Donald Trump to foreign interference. Iran gets little mention. Rarely do we hear much about China. Robert Kaplan wrote a compelling article that explored the need to keep a close eye on this powerful country. Kaplan joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
I want to begin by quoting the heart of your article, America Must Prepare for the Coming Chinese Empire, and then walk through each of these pieces. You write, in functional and historical terms, this will be an imperial struggle between the U.S. and the PRC. Though our elites, both inside and outside government, will forbid the use of the term, the Chinese will have an advantage in this type of competition as they have a greater tradition in empire building than we do, and they are not ashamed of it, as we have become. Moreover, the Chinese have demonstrated an ability to quickly adapt, which is the key to the Darwinian evolutionary model. The continual changes they are making to their Belt and Road model are an example of this. The Chinese also have more capable leadership than we do. Let's start at the beginning. You're all for breaking the China here, Robert. You're not leaving anything unsaid.
Yeah, well, my point is that China is the pacing power. It's the yardstick by which we will measure ourselves over the next few years and decades. And merely by competing with China, we make ourselves better and hopefully avoid a war. Because my bottom line is, compete with China, avoid a violent shooting war with China, and fix up our country at home.
So we have talked many, many times since the beginning of 9/11 through all your many books about America's empire, which is a small footprint in many places and lethal. China is not going that route. They are going for big footprints and ports and roads. They are not at all shy about what they're attempting to do, are they?
No, they believe in geography. Our elites have forgotten geography to a large extent.
Unpack that.
If you look at, you know, if you put on a map where China is building roads and ports and the connecting pathways, it replicates the Yuan and Tang dynasties of the Middle Ages on land and the early Ming dynasty at sea. And it is also the British East India Company in reverse. Rather than going from west to east, as the British East India Company did, China is going from east to west. It's not a specific plan. It's a grand strategy. And what a grand strategy is a basic imprint that you can constantly adjust, constantly change, pull back, move ahead, so when they encounter problems with these infrastructure problems, with these infrastructure projects, they will constantly reassess. That is the Chinese genius, to reassess and learn.
Let me go to this paragraph. We have truly entered an American-Chinese bipolar struggle, but it is a bipolar struggle with an asterisk. The asterisk belongs Russia, which can always inflict consequential damage on the United States. Yet, whereas the Russians appear to our media as classic bad guys, the Chinese are more opaque and businesslike. So the gravity of our competition, and listen to this, America, the gravity of our competition with Beijing is still insufficiently appreciated by our media. Not on this show, but pretty much everywhere else you go, they don't understand what meaning having 400,000 H-1B visa holders in the United States from the People's Republic of China means, Robert Kaplan.
Well, here's what I would say is, you know, we could argue about the visa program, but our media is so, it's so preoccupied at the moment with the crimes of Russia that there is less. You know, they're not covering the China story the way that they could. But one thing that's clear is 10, 15 years ago, China had a lot of friends in Washington, in the media, in Congress, in the government. China under Xi Jinping, which has gone from soft authoritarianism to a more hard-nosed authoritarianism, has much fewer friends. China just doesn't have friends in Washington anymore the way it used to.
Let me pose the key question. Can this marriage be saved? And by that I mean 50 years ago, Richard Nixon in the week that changed the world, and I'm taking over as the president of the Nixon Foundation next week. And we're very proud of that week, and he was very proud of it because he said, we've got to deal with them now when they need us before when we need them, looking 50 years down the road. Can this marriage be saved, Robert Kaplan?
The greatest moral question of the next decade or two, one of the greatest, will be for the Chinese and American governments to prevent a Cold War from ever becoming a hot war. To prevent great power conflict. That should be the moral goal of Beijing and of Washington. It cannot be saved, but it could be prevented from going hot.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Coming up, the effort to take down Judge Kavanaugh.
She was the one who was named as this other witness.
Right.
She's racked her brain, said, I remember so many things about that summer. None of this is lining up with my memory of it. She was utterly ignored.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. When President Donald Trump nominated respected Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, Democrats made a decision to stop at nothing to block his appointment. At the same time, the Me Too movement helped put a spotlight on the horrors of sexual abuse. And Democrats used that sentiment to their advantage, parading anyone with a story, no matter how old, no matter how convoluted, before the Senate to accuse Kavanaugh. This week, a book detailing what happened before America and behind the scenes hit the shelves and quickly shot up the charts. titled Justice on Trial. Authors Molly Gallagher and Carrie Severino joined Mike Gallagher to discuss what they found.
Molly, it's no mystery that President Trump is taking incoming from all sides, and he knows it. I mean, I've met with him in the Oval Office. He gets it. He knows that the whole machine, I don't know that he expected the intensity, but he knows they're coming at him. So when he decides to nominate someone to the Supreme Court, he just figures, I got to get this right. I got enough on my plate. I don't need to have the world come crashing down. He was as confident that this was going to be an unscathed process, right? Talk a little bit about the president's level of confidence when he met with Kavanaugh and said, you're going to breeze through because you're eminently qualified.
Right. He thinks there's no way anybody will have a problem with this guy. He's served on a lower court for 12 years. Everyone loves him. He's got all these opinions that have been upheld by the Supreme Court. So he actually tells him, you're going to have a great, easy time here. But
Cakewalk.
He did... And boy, did that not turn out to be true.
That was not true.
He thinks that's funny, that he thought it would be easy, and it wasn't. But he thinks it's horrible what ended up happening. Now, it is true, though, that Donald Trump took judges very seriously. And we begin looking at this mostly with the death of Antonin Scalia.
Sure.
When he does something very unprecedented that night and names two people who he would like to nominate to the Supreme Court to replace Antonin Scalia. He actually names people. It goes over really well, and he decides to put a list together. And he's thinking, even at that moment, what he wants, the type of people he wants them to be. Originalists, constitutionalists. He wants them to have courage of their convictions, because there have been previous nominees who you thought were going to be good, and then they lacked the courage to see their way through. And he wants them to be young enough that they can serve a long time, that they can have a long impact on the court. And so these are things like this isn't just something that has happened to go well. He puts together a team of people who actually come up with a list of good nominees. And that's not just for the Supreme Court, but for the lower courts as well. And so he understands the importance of judges. He understands that 1 in 4, I think it was, Gary, of his voters voted for him because they wanted him.
Reason.
Yeah, because they knew that it was so important to have good judges and justice.
I have friends who are really ambivalent about his style, his tweets, his personality, but they always come down to... It's the judges. It's the court. This is the stuff that impacts us. And we've talked about, I mean, I've been in this business 40 years. For decades, I've talked about the elections. Elections have consequences. And one big consequence is the complexion of the federal judiciary. And that's what matters to people. I mean, what would the complexion right now today be of the Supreme Court or all the federal judges under President Hillary Clinton?
Yeah. And we write about this a lot, particularly at the end of the book, thinking, what does this mean for the future? And how the challenge here is the liberals have done a very good job of weaponizing the courts. When they can't get something achieved through the political process, they just go to the courts. And all too often, the courts are willing to just kind of go around what the law actually says, what the Constitution says. And so it's a real threat to them to have judges who just say, you know, I'm going to stick with the law. And that's not always a law passed by Republicans.
Right.
It could be a liberal law, too. But that's why the stakes were so high here, because this is threatening the power they had on this branch of government that serves for life, huge, long impact on everything they're doing. So that's why it's so important to know the story of what happened here, because this is going to continue to be a battle going forward. This is a battle for a swing seat being replaced by Trump. Imagine if Justice Ginsburg retired and you have the most liberal member of the court being replaced.
Well,
and I
keep thinking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg now, especially if, as I believe, Trump will get reelected. Although it's all over for him now. Tom Steyer has thrown his hat in the ring, so I don't know. I think the president's going to have a lot of sleepless nights. Ultimately, if he gets reelected, and there after what we went through with Kavanaugh. My Lord, what are we going to go through again? Can they try? They're going to try everything to stop it. And if they were hysterical over Kavanaugh, they're going to be off the charts with the replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I want to go back to the sensitivity of what was alleged of Judge Kavanaugh, because make no mistake, women often are not believed. We all have in our hearts an acknowledgement that the pendulum has sort of shifted. I mean, with this Me Too movement we're in and the era where we're in where women weren't heard, and but you worry about the consequences of a false accusation, which many believe is what happened with Justice Kavanaugh. Molly, Carrie, can you talk about that balancing act of the sensitivity of women who, for example, have been real victims of rape and abuse and feel they don't want the truth to be in any way, you know, obfuscated?
Well, this is what the beauty of due process is you make an accusation, you put forth your evidence, and people are able to evaluate the evidence. And it's because you care about victims and also because you care about wrongfully being accused.
Right.
It's important to balance both of those things. And so when we went into this, I think actually that was probably one of the things we cared about a lot. You know, one of these things you don't think of getting emotional about, but due process is such an, not just an American thing, but just an important thing for justice overall. And in this case, and we detail it in Justice on Trial, the accusations were made lacking any evidence in support. And that was an important thing. What's disconcerting to see is that people say it doesn't matter that there was no evidence to support and that you should just believe people. Well, that just doesn't stand.
It doesn't make sense to just say.
And it's not good for people who are victims of crime to make light of such an important thing.
Right. Yeah.
And it obscures, actually, they're saying believe all women. But what about the women who actually were saying things on the other side? I mean, they were women who knew Kavanaugh well, going back to high school, and said, look, I was there at this time. This doesn't line up with anything that sounds
but
right to me.
They were not to be believed.
You've got women, yeah, like Leland Kaiser. This is a woman who is a lifelong Democrat,
right.
a good friend of Christine Blasey Ford, who wanted to do everything she could to support her. But she sat down and tried to rack her brain because she was the one who was named as this other witness.
Right.
She's racked her brain, said, I remember so many things about that summer. None of this is lining up with my memory of it. She was utterly ignored by the media. And that was something that actually was very chilling for the people who were working on the Kavanaugh nomination, because they thought when her statement came out saying, I was named here, but I don't remember this, they thought, well, that's it. No one now, even her own friend, doesn't remember it. And it was utterly ignored. And that they knew then, oh, now we're in trouble. And of course, it was really interesting when we get into the FBI investigation phase, because she's someone who did speak to the FBI. And by that point, had time to do a lot of reflection and had a lot of questions raising in her own mind about this story.
It's a fascinating look at a process that, I mean, does your gut tell you that it's going to get worse the next time around? Or will we have learned anything from the Kavanaugh chapter?
Yeah, that was one of the reasons we wrote Justice on Trial, because we thought, as traumatic as it was for the nation to go through this, if we don't learn the lesson from this, we are doomed to repeat.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, former President Jimmy Carter.
Trump didn't actually win the election in 2016. He lost the election, and he was put into office because the Russians interfered.
Mike Gallagher reacts in the final segments of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. In this week's special edition, we examine the attacks on what we hold dear.
This is not an option for society. It's foundational to society. That's why every society has something like marriage.
We'll look at what we must defend.
Religious freedom was still considered to be a positive thing, like baseball, apple pie. It's part of America. Now, it's not considered a good word. It's considered a bad word. It's considered license to discriminate.
And how we must defend it.
We've got to stand where we stand. We absolutely cannot render to Caesar what belongs to God.
John Stone Street joins us for a special edition of the program. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Former President Jimmy Carter will turn 95 in October. When he was president, the internet did not exist. Phones were hooked to a wall. Veteran quarterback Aaron Rodgers had yet to be born. Jimmy Carter, he's seen a lot since his days as president of the United States. But one thing that hasn't changed over the years with President Carter, he issues some mighty controversial statements. And he's been at it again. Here's Mike Gallagher.
I'm not trying to be guilty of ageism. I know that Jimmy Carter is 94 years old. I don't care how old or young you are. The Trump derangement syndrome factor is so real. The hatred that people have for this guy, despite this remarkable trip to the DMZ and the success that President Trump continues to have on multiple fronts, that still leads Jimmy Carter to say this at a conference. I don't know, even know this was on C-SPAN. A former president shouldn't do this.
Russia has been proven by our intelligence community to have interfered with one of our human rights, which is the right of free and fair elections. Yeah. What's your reaction? How should we deal with Russia?
Well, the president himself should condemn it, admit that it happened, which I think 16 of intelligence agencies have already agreed to say. And there's no doubt that the Russians did interfere in the election. And I think the interference, although not yet quantified, if fully investigated, would show that Trump didn't actually win the election in 2016. He lost the election, and he was put into office because the Russians interfered on his behalf.
So do you believe President Trump is an illegitimate president?
Based on what I just said, which I can't retract.
I just have to ask you, what compels the Jimmy Carters of the world to say such nonsense? How many voters won't vote for Trump because they think Jimmy Carter is telling the truth? I'll do you one better. Jimmy Carter is attempting to impact the outcome of an election by lying about the 2016 election and poisoning people's minds who are impressionable enough to believe that no former president could possibly be wrong. He must know things. He was the president of the United States. He wouldn't sit at a forum and say Russia changed the outcome if he didn't know something, right? And of course, for the record, he doesn't know anything. Russia didn't change the outcome of the election, and normal, intelligent, rational people know this.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posey and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.